Committee on Fisheries will come to order. The time is 10:02 on Tuesday, April 2nd. Members present are Representative Tarr, Representative Christ Tompkins, Representative Edgman, Representative Vance, and myself, Chair Stutes. This is a friendly reminder to make sure your cell phones are on silent, and we're asking that the audience not approach the committee table. If you need to pass a note, please get the attention of my committee aide, Matt Greening, who's right over here on my left, and he'd be happy to help you out. I'd like to thank Butch Carver, the Fisheries Secretary, and Eileen Keim from the Juno LIO for technical support and teleconferencing, and welcome Representative Kopp. It's my intent to conclude this meeting by 11:30 for House rules, and I will be enforcing the decorum of the Brevity Caucus today. Up first, the committee will hear House Bill 99, the New Yakuk River Falls Hydroelectric Site by Representative Edgman. This is the first hearing on this bill, and at this point, the intent of the chair and the sponsor is simply to explore the issue and have a discussion. As such, the sponsor, Representative Edgman, has some opening remarks, which will be followed by invited testimony. Online and available for questions of this bill, we have Ricky Geese, Director of State Parks, and Mark Lysak in Dillingham. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, if you'd please identify yourself and your affiliation for the record and tell us a bit about the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Bryce Edgman, I represent House District 37, which also includes the Bristol Bay area, which is what the subject of the bill addresses today. House Bill 99, basically, in a sort of a summarized fashion, would provide a local power cooperative that's member-owned and operated out of the Dillingham area, servicing four communities with power and telephone, internet, and things like that. But it would basically allow the local cooperative the ability to do some feasibility studies, to do some impact studies on fish and wildlife and water quality and some other things, on what appears to be a very promising hydro project that's also within the confines of the nearby Wood-Tikchik State Park, which coincidentally at 1.6 million acres is the largest state park in the United States, a little known fact out in Bristol Bay. But in order for the cooperative to do these studies, and again the road from sort of doing the feasibility all the way to perhaps the development stage somewhere down the pike, it's going to be a long and involved process in a project that is estimated to cost well over $100 million, but with some initial data at hand already is proving to be very much worthy of the exploration that it would take to again get it permitted and then ultimately built. But to sort of wrap my comments up, House Bill 99 gives the cooperative the ability to, in state statute, to, in Title 41, the statutes that sort of frame the Wood-Tikchik State Park and what can be done and not done within the park, but it gives the cooperative the ability to essentially go in and do these studies by placing into Title 41, along with Lake Elva and Grant Lake, the words, or the New Yakuk River Falls, which would be considered incompatible with the uses of the state park. So with that sort of quick prefacing of the bill, Madam Chair, I would certainly answer any questions, but I think would recommend or defer immediately to the members of the cooperative who are here to talk in more detail about the project and what the studies would entail.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Are there any questions? Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, and I could save this for later or for the cooperative, but I'd come across the New Yakuk River Falls project before and was really intrigued, but am not familiar with any, at least at one point in time, proposed projects with Lake Elva and Grant Lake, and was wondering if the cooperative maybe just could do a sort of primer history on sort of how they ended up in statute and what the hydro potential is at each of those sites as well.
Thank you. I'm sure that will be inclusive in their presentation. Seeing no other questions, here in person, we have Mr. Robert Heimschut, CEO and General Manager of the Neugashic Electric, and Henry Strube, Board President of Neugashic. Heimschut. Thank you. Sorry. Robert Heimschut, for the record. And Henry Strube. If you would come forward and identify yourself at the table and your affiliation and proceed with your presentation, that would be just great.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Henry Strube. I'm a 30-year-plus member of Neugashic Cooperative Board of Directors, and I currently serve as Vice President. I'm also a 42-year commercial fisherman in Bristol Bay. And I think that Bryce Edgman, Representative Edgman, gave a good encapsulation of what we're trying to do.
Madam Chair, Committee, I'm Robert Heimschut, the CEO, General Manager at Neugashic. Been a member of the Dillingham community since 1998, fortunate enough to be in this current position since June of 2017. I also agree that the Speaker Edgman gave a concise overview of what we're trying to do here. I've been a fisherman in the Bristol Bay area since 1999. I've got 20 years of set netting there, so my my perspective is that of the communities, that the fish are the most important resource that we have. I have a short PowerPoint presentation that will familiarize the committee with our project, and then I can get into the importance of House Bill 99. We also have Corey Warnock from McMillan Jacobs on the phone. McMillan Jacobs is the engineering firm that we're using to evaluate the project and also help us through the FERC licensing process. They come with the recommended experience. So, sorry about the low speech there. Moving into the PowerPoint, if that's okay with Madam Chair.
Please. Yeah.
So our project sits at Neugashic Falls. It's naturally a very advantageous place for a hydroelectric production. There's a glacier moraine that forms the eastern boundary of the lake system. That glacier moraine creates a natural dam, and the falls are the spillway over that dam. What we're looking to do is just divert some of the water around the falls and use it for power production. There's been a flow monitoring station. That USGS has a flow monitoring program. The station's been there since 1953. We have the advantage of having 60 years of data to do some modeling over using that data to try to determine what the power production would be from a system in those falls. Using 25% of the flow, the minimum that we would see on average over the three lowest months was 4.5 megawatts to considerably greater than 10 megawatts. We stopped the study at 10 megawatts, but using a quarter of the flow at high flow times, we're pushing 30 megawatts. It's enough production not only for Dillingham and Aliknagik, the service area for Neugashic, but for regional distribution as well. So our project proposes this to be the power system for several of the Neugashic River and northern Bristol Bay communities. The flow data and the potential power production matches the demand needs of our system, which is really driven by salmon processing in the summer. In Dillingham, we run about 2 megawatts through the winter on a constant base load, but in the summer we're as high as 5 megawatts, and as we add in the new processing facility down at Icicle, we'll be closer to 8 megawatts. That seasonal demand is mirrored across our region for salmon processing. The potential of this particular site and the flows match that demand very well. So the falls create, or the falls occur at an oxbow in the river. Excuse me. The intake would come above the falls, and we would divert the water to below the falls and power production facility at the base of the falls. There would be about 2,500 feet to 3,000 feet of river affected by about 1,500 foot of penstock. It's actually, engineering-wise, it's a very advantageous place. As you can see, there would not be much of the river affected by this. We would pull the intake right from above the falls with nothing but a diversion and drop it back in below the falls. If we use 25% or less of the flow, if that's what the study showed was available, you'd have 75% remaining in the natural course of the river. So the salmon return, the transverse of the falls, both from adult salmon and from smolt, would use the same passage they always have. This is just a line drawing of the potential distribution. The hydro plant, we're looking at the communities of Dillingham, Olicknagik, Koliginix, Duyahawk, Ekwok, and Leavelock. Our modeling also shows that the production capabilities may be enough to include Naknek, King Salmon, and South Naknek. That would increase the viability of this project considerably if that proved out to be the case. The other advantage we have here is the current broadband middle mile system. The hardline fiber that starts the microwave system ends in Leavelock. So this would allow us to bring fiber along that path, which we would do anyway for SCADA control purposes for the system. It would give us a broadband path to all these communities. So if you just take in the communities through Leavelock, we'd be looking at displacing 1.5 million gallons of fuel annually. The estimated cost to build, including studies, is 120 to 150 million. At the current $2.51 a gallon blended rate in Dillingham, and that's not considering the cost of fuel in the upriver villages, just Dillingham, we're displacing $150 million worth of fuel cost over a 40-year licensing period, $9 million worth of known generator maintenance costs scheduled, $12 million regulatory compliance. So just those items added together show a displaced cost of $171 million. This slideshow is an abbreviated version of the presentation that we've done for community outreach. So when the board decided that they wanted to pursue this project, we knew that it was going to be regional in nature. We also knew that we needed to build broad support for the project, or there wouldn't be no reason to go forward with it. We have done over 70 meetings and presentations. All the local communities that would be affected. We've been to Juneau a couple of times, Bristol Bay Area Heritage Land Trust. We've been to D.C. with this. We've tried to blanket and include as many people as possible to see if there was going to be anyone that would not be supportive of us moving forward with this project. Part of those meetings were the fact that this was inside the Wood-Tikchik-Sake Park and that we had a couple of options for completing the studies, one of which was a land swap that would actually change the boundaries of the park. That in the end didn't make a whole lot of sense. There was a lot of reasons why that wasn't a good path forward. The other was to use the statutes that already exist. To answer Representative Christ Tompkins' question through the chair, when the Wood-Tikchik State Park was established, the enabling statutes recognized hydro as one of the potential uses of the state park, and they called out two particular sites that had been identified in advance, Grant and Elva Lake, and specifically for power production for Dillingham and Alicnagik. When one of the things that Nooshagak has evaluated in the past, because we were constantly looking for a path not to be on diesel, we want to convert to something more sustainable. We evaluated both of those. Neither one of them turned out to be financially feasible because of the lack of power production. So if you look in the park management plan now, you'll see that in the verbiage of the plan, it shows not only the inclusion of those sites, but the results of those studies. What we want to do here is the same exact thing we did for Grant and Elva. We want to go study this potential hydro site, see if it is feasible both environmentally and financially for development, and if it is, use it to move the region off of diesel. Each one of those communities identified in that PowerPoint presentation is 100% diesel generation right now. That would move, this has got the potential to turn those diesels off 24/7.
Are there questions from this committee? Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you. For the record, big fan of your sister, Mr. Hemshute. And a couple of questions. It's really exciting to see the I mean, I know how hard it is to find projects that get communities off diesel, off the rail belt. And I was curious if the $120 to $150 million estimated project price is inclusive of transmission line infrastructure.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. And follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up.
And then my other question out of curiosity is you mentioned the base load for presumably Dillingham Alicnagik, which already have a transmission line, and I think you said maybe 2 megawatts or so in the winter. And I was curious what the marginal increase base load would be if you count Kilikinik, Ekwok, Levelock, and Nustoyahok as well.
Sorry, through Madam Chair, would you repeat that again?
Might have been a little unclear. If you add those other villages, how much increased base load is there?
Through Madam Chair, right now Dillingham's about 2 megawatts in the winter. Those villages would increase about a half a megawatt base load. The Naknek area, Naknek, King Salmon, South Naknek, about 1.5 meg. So the 4.5 meg that we're capable of producing, even in the low water flow times, would be enough to keep the diesels off in all those communities.
Another question, Representative Cobb.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for the presentation, sir. As someone who's lived out in Naknek for a long time, and also a fellow Setnetter out there near Graveyard Point. This project has enormous potential. You know, the replacement of fuel oil. I'm one of those people that's paid $1,500 a month for fuel oil in the winter out there. So I see that. Also, there has been a long successful project that the Inn Electric Co-op has done out of Iliamna. They power Iliamna, New Halen, and Elm Dalton on a 1.5 megawatt. As of 99 when it was done, I think they actually can get maybe up to 2 now out of that, but it's a very successful project. I know that it's really cut down on diesel and other fuels in those communities at Tazimina Falls, I think, or I'm not sure I pronounced that right, but it's just northeast of Lake Iliamna. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to point out this is a 20-year-old hydro project, Madam Chair, that's been very successful in those communities. And Levelock here on the map is trying to get a large fish processing facility in there. I'm sure they would be thrilled to have this project go forward. So I'm very excited about its possibilities. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kopp. And for myself, coming from Kodiak and having Kodiak Electric with our windmills and our hydro project and our hydro dam, we are 99.7% renewable energy. And not only is this good for the people that live there, but it's an economic driver. We have good solid processors there, and we have more processors moving in because they can afford to process in our community because electricity is reasonable. Not only do we have homes being built now that are electric, which is almost unheard of, we have homes that are changing daily from oil, heat, and oil dependability to heat pumps with electricity. So it's just a win-win deal, and I'm really excited to hear this. I feel privileged to come from a community that had the foresight to do this many years ago and keep the promoting of it going forward. So, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You have cost of the overall project, but do you have it broken down as to how much the approximate cost per home? You know, as Representative Kopp mentioned, he's paid $1,500 a month in fuel cost, and I know that that's a pretty real number. But what are the projections for the utility costs after the plant is in production?
Representative Vance, through the chair, so much of that is going to be determined through these studies and through the design process. The estimate we have right now of $150 million in the costs we know we can displace, the one thing that I can say for sure is that there would not be an increase to costs. But through this process and using this as a regional driver, we expect to be able to provide to pursue some grant funding for some of the builds, and hopefully drive those costs down from where they currently sit. Part of what we're looking at this project for, everything, all the cost modeling that we do is based on a 40-year license from FERC. You look at hydropower production, including the room we sit in right now with this Nenasham system here. 40 years is a very short term for hydro. Some of them have been producing for over 100 years. So the immediate costs and how we can affect those is going to depend on how advantageously we can build the system. The long term, though, the generations that are provided power off this system past that first 40-year cycle will be able to enjoy the mature hydro rates that places like Juneau, Kodiak, the INN, you know, Iliamna, New Halen area. You can go on and on, Valdez, Cordova, all these places that have mature hydro have rates that we're envious of and want to get to.
Follow up,
Representative Vance.
Yes, on the Lower Peninsula, we have Bradley Lake that has been said to be one of the wiser decisions that the state has made to allow the affordable energy, and we still rely on a portion of fuel and are still looking for more ways to capture the hydro, and Grant Lake is one of those that is in the process of the permitting to be utilized. So with understanding that this is a lengthy, time-consuming process, it is exciting that we can create affordable energy without having to haul the diesel and deal with more of the concerns that has on our environment. And really, it's impressive to see that you don't need a dam in this, and that it allows for the fish habitat to continue to pass through with 75% of the water. It's very exciting to see how far we've come in that, and hope that this is something that you'll be able to move forward with.
Thank you. And if I see no further questions from this committee, I am going to move forward with our other invited testimony for the sake of timeliness. And so thank you very much for your testimony. And up next on the phone, we have Corey Warnock with McMillan Jacobs to discuss the FERC process and permitting. Mr. Warnock, Are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me okay, Madam?
We can hear you just great. If you'd identify yourself and your affiliation for the record and begin your presentation, please.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. I apologize for not being able to be there in person. My name is Corey Warnock. I'm a senior regulatory and natural resource project manager for McMillan Jacobs. Our firm is based in Boise. I'm actually located just a little bit north of Seattle, Washington. I'm a fisheries biologist by trade, but have been immersed in the regulatory and natural resource sides of hydroelectric licensing, relicensing, and compliance for about the past 20 years. A majority of my work has taken me to Alaska and all around the Pacific Northwest, actually right now Grant Lake, which was just mentioned on the Kenai Peninsula included. I've been assisting the Nishigaat Cooperative and Mr. Hemshoop for about the past year, exploring the initial feasibility of the New Yukuk Falls hydroelectric project. And I think that the primary reason I'm here is in conversations with a variety of folks. I've been hearing some concern related to this House bill potentially allowing for the expedited development of this project prior to fully exploring the feasibility therein. And I just am here to provide some additional clarity and context if needed with respect to the intent of this bill versus the overall onerous and requisite FERC licensing process that will need to take place. One phase of that FERC licensing process is to collect all existing baseline natural resource data and then to go through an involved process with state and federal agencies to determine additional study needs, both natural resource and engineering related, to determine if the site and the design of the project are feasible and will not impact the environment in a significantly adverse fashion. And so again, my primary role here, I think, in addition to answering questions, is just to shed light on that regulatory process and the overall time-consuming and amount of effort that will need to go into that over the course of the next 5 or 6 years to ultimately bring this project to fruition if the site is deemed feasible for construction and operation.
Thank you, Mr. Warnock. So it sounds like if I misunderstood what you were saying, but it sounds like what we're doing here and initially putting this bill out and having this hearing isn't going to circumvent any of the steps that are going to be required by anyone in the FERC process. Is that correct? That it'll be
Madam Chair, that's correct. This bill would essentially allow the cooperative to begin the study development and implementation process necessary to inform that FERC process. It would in no way circumvent or avoid it.
And can you give me an idea, if you have one, on the time frame that's involved in getting a FERC permit?
Madam Chair, yes, with the understanding that, you know, every project has its own individual sort of intricacies I guess, supplemental issues. With respect to this project and in Alaska overall, I'm going to give you a range, a 5 to 7 year time frame, assuming that there are no significant hurdles or speed bumps associated with legislation or things like that is usually a fair estimate.
And I'm going to ask one last question, and I see Representative Christ-Tompkin has a question, so I'll let him go first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very generous. I also had a question similar to Madam Chair, and I think I heard the words time-consuming, onerous, and burdensome in your initial testimony, and I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on what's entailed in the FERC permitting process in the 5 to 7 years that you described.
Absolutely, through Madam Chair. I'm not sure I used burdensome, but I don't know that I would hesitate. Time-consuming, there are a series of phases, the first of which the cooperative has entered into now. Approximately 9 months ago, they applied for and received a preliminary permit from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and essentially all of that does is provide them priority to the site to explore the feasibility of it. That initial permit will give them a 3-year time span to do so, at the end of which, if they have shown enough progress towards the feasibility exploration phase, they will likely be afforded an additional two-year extension. During that five-year window, post-baseline data acquisition, the primary components that go into that would be agency interaction. And when I say agency interaction, I mean everything from state, federal agencies, tribal entities, public interests, FERC. We all sit down and collaborate together on the development of a robust study program, and that is everything from aquatics to water resources to water quality to terrestrial, cultural, rec and viz, tribal interests, that will fully inform and cross-reference with the design and development of this project to determine if the impacts to the local environment are severe or significant enough to essentially nix it, or to say, no, the development and the benefits to this project do not outweigh the adverse impacts. Once those studies are completed, we reconvene with all of the agencies to discuss the results, make those determinations, and if everyone is generally in agreement that the project shall move forward, each of those agencies goes away and develops a series of terms and conditions that they would like to see incorporated into that eventual FERC operating license. The entity, in this case the cooperative, would file a final license application with FERC. Those terms and conditions would come in from those agencies to supplement that, and then it would essentially take go into what we call phase three typically, and would be in FERC's hands for a full comprehensive review and determination as to whether or not the project is viable. If it is, certain terms and conditions are mandatorily required to be incorporated into that license. Others are taken into consideration and incorporated where deemed appropriate, and a license is issued. So I know that was a really long-winded way of saying onerous, but it hopefully highlights the time-consuming nature of one of these processes. And typically, when someone enters into a process like this, hopefully they've been advised appropriately and they don't take that process lightly, because it is there is a lot of effort that goes into it.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Oh, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question. I was looking at the Google Earth for the Nooshiegak, and I'm just trying to look and see, are there other places that have any hydro potential, or is that part of what will be worked on, or has that already been looked at? Because I'm just noticing it looks like if there was anything sort of closer to Dillingham or closer to the mouth of the river, that you could loop all those communities in a little more compactly. And so I imagine you looked at that, but I just wonder in that watershed if there's other opportunities for hydro.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, we've looked pretty extensively for those opportunities. The search that led to this site was what we feel fairly comprehensive. When you look at the technical engineering requirements, you know, head and flow of developing hydropower, this is the one place we were able to identify that would have the ability to do a regional production. There are other in-stream production facilities that are being tested, one notably in Igiagig, but I believe their production is a 25 kilowatt turbine. Mm. As compared to what we're looking at, you know, potentially as high as 30 megawatts. Mm-hmm. The two are really apples and oranges.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, could I elaborate on that just a little?
Certainly.
Bit? That as well?
Certainly.
So the
if you'd identify yourself again for the record, please.
Oh, yeah, Corey Warnock with McMillan Jacobs Associates. I apologize. The only things that I would add or supplement Mr. Hemsheed's comment with is to say that from a biological perspective, this site on the Nooyakuk, or within the Nooyakuk drainage, is relatively unique because of the small footprint that the project would encompass. Mm-hmm. There is a very small patch of this river that would be impacted in any way as a result of project construction and operation, and it just so happens that small section coincides with what we're calling the falls, And from a biological perspective, that is relatively significant because the amount of viable habitat, be it either rearing or spawning, for many of the anadromous and resident salmonids that exist in this system would not be impacted as a result. So I think, and this was prior to me becoming involved in the project, but I think when they started to explore potentially feasible sites, this is one of the things that attracted them. And just speaking from someone who's come on in the last year, from an engineering perspective and from a natural resource perspective, that's what makes the site quite appealing.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Can you give us an idea, a ballpark, and when I say ballpark, I'm giving you a lot of latitude, on what the cost might be from the beginning of this process to when the permit may finally be issued?
Yes. So we're talking about the cost for undertaking all of the regulatory, natural resource, and engineering things associated with the licensing process itself?
Correct. From the beginning of when you decide this is what we're going to do until when the FERC permit crosses the line.
Sure. And with Madam Chair, with the understanding that the ballpark is a big one, because there's a lot of variables out there that will ultimately define that, we've put together an estimate for natural resource studies, which is admittedly just one component of that, in the $6 million range, and then supplemented that with regulatory services, which delves into everything from, you know, agency consultation, meeting facilitation, document development, and also engineering feasibility. I would say $10 to $20 million, and that is a broad range that is going to be ultimately refined and hopefully minimized to the extent possible as we know more.
Wow. Representative Christ Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A two-part question, I guess. The first is you spoke a little bit to this with this sort of being not quite run of river, but I don't actually know what the technical, it's sort of ish run of river hydro project, what the anticipated impact on anadromous fish, if any, would be. And then the second part of the question is, in this ballpark $10 to $20 million permitting process to satisfy all the criteria that Mr. Warnock spoke to earlier entailed in a FERC permit, what kinds of studies or what the footprint of studies would be in summer and winter to sort of get through that process?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I can definitely touch on the second one with respect to some of the priority studies. This is Corey Warnock again.
Thank you.
With respect to some of the primary studies that we've identified, and I'll give you a couple examples of site-specific needs. In the first year of the study program, we would certainly be doing some geotechnical work, which would include analysis of the substrate, both in bed and through what we're calling this little bluff section. And keep in mind, please, that I'm not an engineer, but this would confirm that the type of rock or type of substrate that we're going to be utilizing for development of this project, development of the penstock and the tunnel, the intake anchoring, is conducive to, you know, withstanding the type of force that the river puts on it and the amount of infrastructure that we would be putting in there. That is a relatively involved study in and of itself, but it's one that we always like to do up front, because if it turns out that our initial site visits and baseline data are incorrect once we get into the ground, well, you know, then that would be a non-starter. From a natural resource perspective, one of the very first and high priority studies that we would be looking at would be those Nuyukuk Falls specifically. As I mentioned, overall, the swath of habitat that would be impacted by this project would be would be quite minimal. But the falls themselves would be the area that we would call a bypass reach, or the area of the river where water would be moved around to develop power. So we would be looking at the flow through those falls to ensure that safe, effective, and timely passage of both upstream migrating adults and downstream migrating juveniles was maintained throughout the entire year. And another unique feature of this project, and we've seen this on our site visits, is that these falls at certain times of year that coincide actually with upstream migration of certain anadromous species, that river provides flows at some points that actually create what we call a velocity barrier over those falls, and it sometimes can prohibit upstream migration. So while it's certainly not a confirmation yet, the reality or the possibility exists that removing some of those top-end flows over those falls at certain times of year would actually provide more safe, timely, and effective passage than natural conditions currently allow. That's a very involved study because it's a very big river, and it's you know, at times has very high flows. So those would be two of the upfront primary studies. Now, with all of that being said, there's not a lot of existing data for this remote location. So in addition to that, there would be a series of studies devoted to, as I said earlier, fisheries, water quality, terrestrial resources, cultural and rec and viz, that would more globally and comprehensively investigate the project area for species presence, species composition, determine the water quality, the current natural water quality conditions, and all of that would sort of coalesce into a model or a series of models during the data analysis phase, which again would be cross-referenced with project design to determine how natural conditions would be, if at all, impacted by project operations.
Thank you. Okay. We have one more bill to hear. We have until 11:30, so I'm going to allow Representative Kopp. You had a question?
Yes, briefly. This may be for the bill presenters. Will the Nuyukuk Hydroelectric Project be owned cooperatively with any other co-ops, or are you envisioning it just being the Nooshinggak Cooperative? I saw in the notes there that Naknek Electric has also pursued a FERC permit and needs access to the park for feasibility, according to their resolution. So, in other words, the management plan of the park has to be updated to show this is a compatible use, just like you're asking for. So they put that in their resolution. I'm just wondering how that relationship seems like we have two co-ops very interested in getting power out of this area.
Representative Kopp, through the chair.
If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Oh, Robert Hemshute. I believe that's a misunderstanding. Their resolution was in support of our efforts, not in introduction of their own efforts. As far as the final governance of this project and ownership of this project, I think we're too early in the process to really tell. We do know that because of both the power production capability and the cost, that this really needs to be a regional project. So to make this project work, there will be accommodations on a regional basis. How that eventually ends up, I think we're way early in the process to make that determination. We have had some speculative conversations that way. What we have in front of us, though, is, you know, Nooshinggak has decided to pursue the study, you know, for licensing and evaluation of this site. And as we go through that process, as things develop towards the licensing, and everything is still showing that it is a developable site, it's one of those conversations that will develop.
My apologies, Madam Chair. He's correct that it was in support of Nooshinggak Electric Co-ops. I misread that.
Thank you. Lastly, Representative Christ-Tompkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And remember, we're in the brevity caucus.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I really appreciate Mr. Warnock's comments, and I miss out on a sort of confirm an understanding, and that talking about the falls is basically a velocity barrier to fish passage. It sounds as though there's a certain scenario in which development of this project in sort of a roundabout way almost serves as a fish pass. I know in Southeast Alaska we have those where you've got a barrier and it provides a means for fish to get by, and I mostly wanted to confirm whether I'm sort of understanding the testimony correctly.
Yeah, this is Corey Warnock, and Madam Chair. Yeah, you. I think you are. We use the term velocity barrier, sort of from a fisheries perspective, to define a natural condition where water flow that's coming over some sort of control or falls in this case impedes in any way upstream movement of adult anadromous salmonids. And so, having been to the site at the appropriate time to see reds moving upstream, we saw quite a few fish that were prohibited via primary access routes up the falls from moving upstream as a result of flows that were in excess of what they could accommodate, either sort of what we, from a burst speed perspective. The falls are a relatively long swath of cascades where high energy is required for a lengthy period of time to navigate. And again, these flows were in excess of what some could accommodate when you were there. Does that help?
It does. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Gentlemen, thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. We certainly appreciate you taking your time to come and testify before this committee. And before we set this bill aside, I would like to give Speaker Edgman an opportunity. If you have any comments, Speaker Edgman.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure that the you know, in my mind, I, from our perspective as legislators, in a much grander scale, of course, I'm thinking of the gas line in Alaska and how there are just an infinite number of stages at each sort of segment from the exploration level all the way to the development stage. And this project sort of mirrors that to me. But I guess very quickly, given that our time is limited, I'd like to know perhaps from the CEO of Michigan Cooperative, if at any point in this up to 20 million or plus sort of exploratory phase, would the cooperative you know, be compelled to say, look, this just isn't going to work, and we're you know, at that go or no go sort of point in the decision tree. So could Madam Chair, if he could just amplify on that quickly.
Representative Edgman, through the chair, absolutely. Mr. Warnock gave a description of exactly how we'd be looking at some of these studies, doing some of the more critical studies earlier in the process, the ones that have a go/no-go bearing on the project. And if any of those came back with negative results, impediments that put a put the project in jeopardy, then we would stop what we're doing, evaluate the information we had, and make a decision whether this was a process we wanted to follow or not. Nooshigak is not a large cooperative, and we want to explore this for the benefit of our members, but part of that responsibility is exploring it in a financially responsible manner as well.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess my final point would be that I think today's testimony has also sort of illustrated that this project is highly speculative. It's multi-years in the making, just in the exploratory phase itself, and that, you know, were this bill to be passed, you know, I don't know that it actually opens up the doors for some private company to come in and look at this as a sort of a business undertaking from a for-profit perspective, because you don't even know if you get past the first stage to the geotechnical phase where you figure out whether the ground is strong enough to absorb the in-river, you know, mechanism itself. So I just wanted to be clear about that as we sort of wrap up the conversation, that this is a pretty involved process, you know, and from a business standpoint, for a small non-for-profit, you're going to be looking at all your nickels and dimes from year one out, because if you get too far in the red on this, then as we saw with the other two projects in the park, you got pretty quickly to the no-go stage of, you know, the decision tree.
Gentlemen, again, the committee thanks you for taking your time to testify before us. So thank you. And we will be setting House Bill 99 aside for a future date. Thank you. The committee thanks you. Next up, we will have House Bill 105, Fisherman's Fund Vessel Owner Claims, by Representative Ortiz. The intent of the chair is to hear the bill presentation, take committee questions, hear invited and public testimony and set the bill aside for further consideration on Thursday. So, available in the room, we have Gray Mitchell, Director of the Workman's Compensation Division, Velma Thomas, Program Coordinator, Workers' Compensation Division, Representative Ortiz and his staff, Liz Harpold, are here to present the bill. So if you would identify yourself for the record and tell us about your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dan Ortiz. I represent District 36, Southern Southeast Alaska.
And for the record, Liz Harpold, staff to Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of this esteemed committee, for agreeing to hear HB 105. HB 105 is a simple bill. I say that, but fully expecting the inquisitive minds of the members of this committee to ask me about the bill. But nevertheless, the Fisherman's Fund, this particular bill was heard by the Fisheries Committee last year, and it passed out of the committee last year, so it's a repeat of that particular bill. And it's based on the Fisherman's Fund itself, which was created in 1951 and provides the treatment and care of Alaska's licensed and commercial fishermen who have been injured while fishing onshore or offshore in Alaska. It's created by fishermen for fishermen from a portion of every commercial fisherman's license fee. In 2010, the legislature amended the Fisherman's Fund statutes to allow a vessel owner to file a claim against the fund for 50% of the owner's protection and indemnity insurance deductible from the fund. A vessel owner could file a claim if an injured crew member filed a claim against both the Fisherman's Fund and the vessel owner's protection and indemnity insurance. The idea behind this is that the Fisherman's Fund is essentially a payer of last resort. If a vessel owner carries P&I insurance to fully cover crew members' medical expenses in the event of an injury, then there will be a reduced burden on the Fisherman's Fund itself. HB 105, in summary, Madam Chair, will allow an owner to fully recover the P&I deductible from the fund up to the amount of $5,000. Again, this is the Fisherman's Fund. It's important to remember that we're not talking anything in this bill in relationship to any obligations from the state, any resources from the state, or anything like that. The Fisherman's Fund is self-funded by the fishermen themselves. So with that, Madam Chair, we have Mr. Gray Williams, Director of Workman's Compensation, and Ms. Velma Thomas, a program coordinator. They're both here to answer any questions that committee members might have about this particular bill.
Thank you. Are there questions from this committee?
Sure.
Representative?
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Ortiz, for bringing this bill forward. So have we looked at any modeling on claims to know what is paid out of the fund, maybe over a rolling 5 or 10 year, whatever you have, and then because then it's easier to kind of get our mind around that the fund is a payer of last resort and the incentivizing these P&I policies by individual fishermen. I do like the idea of having help with the pay down the deductible on your own policy. Just wondering if you had any modeling on that.
Through the chair, very good question, Representative Kopp. So some information that I can share with you right now that was from in 2014, there was $10,000 reimbursed out of the fund out of a total deductible of $20,000. 2015, there was $12,250 out of a total deductible of $37,000. 2016, there was $15,000 reimbursed deductible out of a $135,500 deductible. And then in 2017, there was $27,500 out of a $140,000 deductible. I think your question probably, Representative Kopp, relates more to the sustainability of the fund itself and making sure that if we were to pass HB 105, that it, in fact, the fund would be sustainable. We'd be able to continue to see a growth of that fund, and there wouldn't be any impact on the overall, again, sustainability of the fund. And I can say that that's of the most paramount importance to the managers of the fund themselves, and and they support this bill, and they recognize that bottom line is the fund needs to be sustainable for future generations, future fishermen, and all those kinds of things, and they believe that the passage of this bill will not impact the sustainability of the fund itself.
Thank
in
you.
Any negative
other
way.
Questions? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's just kind of a follow-up to the question is, how much is in the Fisherman's Fund and how much is contributed on an annual basis?
Through the Chair, Representative Vance, the current value of the fund is $11.7 million. The value over time, 10-year average, has been about $11.5 million. And every year, there's about $1.1 million that goes into it. And to follow up with Representative Kopp's question, last year there were 110 crew member claims that were filed in 2018 and paid out for a little over $500,000 total. And then in 2017, there were 294 crew member claims, and that value paid out was around $731,000, just over that. So as you can see, the number of crew member claims is quite a bit higher than vessel owner claims. And so by shifting the burden onto the vessel owner's P&I insurance, it'll help reduce that burden onto the Fisherman's Fund itself.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, we will go Representative Kreis-Tompkins.
Thank you. I had a question, I think, in this line about the fiscal note. I just want to make sure I'm reading the fiscal note right, which notes $16,100 increase grants and benefits, and that is the projected increased liability to the Fisherman's Fund, and it just seems like a small number. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, it seems like this isn't imperiling the solvency or self-sufficiency of the Fisherman's Fund, which is, I think, what we all want. But I just wanted to make sure I'm understanding that number right.
Through the Chair, Representative Kreis-Tompkins, yes, the increased burden is estimated to be around an additional $16,000 by looking at the average payout of to vessel owners being around like $2,300 per claim, and that's because of the 50% of their deductible being able to be paid out. If we up it to no more than $5,000 or the full amount, that increased burden would maybe be an additional $2,300 per claim. And based on the number of claims that they've had, they assume that it would probably be around $16,000 more per year that'll be coming out of the fund for the vessel owner claims.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Seeing no other questions, we will go to invited testimony. And we have Bob Kehoe, Executive Director of the Purse Seine Vessels Association. Mr. Kehoe, if you
yes,
would identify
here,
yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bob Kehoe, and I'm the Executive Director of the Purse Seine Vessel Owners Association. PSUA is a commercial fishing trade association representing the small boat fleet operating throughout Alaska and the West Coast. Among other things, PSUA manages three fisherman-owned marine insurance pools, which include approximately 900 member vessels. All profits generated by these marine insurance pools are distributed back to membership, which helps keep down the cost of hull and liability insurance. And the bill references protection and indemnity insurance, and I heard Representative Ortiz mention that. Just for the record, it's a kind of a fancy name for liability insurance. So PSUA supports House Bill 105, and we thank Representative Ortiz for sponsoring the bill. The bill expands upon the legislature's effort in 2010 to provide a financial incentive to vessel owners who obtain insurance to fully cover their crew members in the event of an injury. Vessel owners are not required by law to carry insurance for their crew members, which is different than shoreside employers who are required by law to insure their employees under the state workers' compensation system. In addition, the cost of vessel insurance is relatively high compared to the rates paid by shoreside employers. For example, a purse-seine operation typically has four crew members, and the cost of insuring the crew can be as high as $400 per man per month. As small independent business owners, the cost of liability insurance is a major fixed cost. This bill will ease the financial burden on vessel owners in paying the cost of insurance by allowing them to recover up to their full deductible up to $5,000 in the event of a claim, and will further promote the goal of ensuring all of the medical needs of injured crew members are satisfied. Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's the end of my testimony. Happy to answer any questions.
Appreciate it. Are there any questions for Mr. Kehoe? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kehoe. We appreciate it, and I see no questions for you. Next, we have Clay Besneck in Ketchikan.
Good morning here. Can everybody hear me all right?
We can hear you just great. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please, and your affiliation.
Very good. My name's Clay Besneck, and I'm a commercial fisherman from Ketchikan, Alaska.
And you can begin your testimony.
Oh, very good. Well, as a commercial fisherman, we sometimes wear a lot of hats, and one of my hats is I was appointed to serve on the Fisherman's Fund Board a couple of years ago, and now, just like everything else, 15 years or 13 years gone by, and just like drop of a hat. But we've worked while on our tenure on the board, fishermen from all around the state, and we've just tried to make it better our whole term that we've been on there. And in 2009, we came up with legislation to change the fund from $2,500 to $10,000 because we figured it wasn't going to hurt the fund. The claims have been going down. A lot of people figured because of Coast Guard training, AMC training, just training in general, and Coast Guard guidance in that training, and a lot of times with tickets. So this was something similar. When we did the 2010 legislation, we realized we had a little bit of problem that insured vessel owners were getting kind of penalized, because if you're uninsured, the fund would pay up to $10,000 of benefits if your claim fell into the criteria that we need. But if you have an insurance, then you only got half that money back. And we go, well, you're penalizing the people that have insurance. We got to change that. And we looked at the financials and looked at the status of the fund, and we realized it's a good thing to do. And like PSVOA with Mr. Keogh, there we're also thankful for Representative Ortiz for bringing this forward, and we support it 100% on our Fisherman's Fund Board.
Thank you. Are there any questions from this committee? Seeing none, we appreciate your taking your time for testifying. Next, we have in the room Francis Leach from UFA. If you would identify yourself and your affiliation for the record, please.
Good morning, Chair Stutes and members of the House Fisheries Committee. For the record, my name is Francis Leach, and I'm the Executive Director of United Fishermen of Alaska. We are a statewide commercial fishing trade organization representing 35 commercial fishing organizations and hundreds of commercial fishermen and crew members around the state. I'll make this short and sweet. UFA would like to go on the record in support of House Bill 105, and we thank Representative Ortiz for bringing this bill forth. Crew members working on commercial fishing vessels are not covered under Alaska's workers' compensation system. If a crew member is injured while working on a vessel, they're entitled to receive benefits from their employer that are established under federal general maritime law. These benefits include payment of a crew member's medical bills for treatment of a work-related injury. This bill provides an additional incentive to commercial fishing vessel owners to purchase liability insurance for crew members in order to cover the full cost of an injured crew member's medical care in the event of an injury, rather than rely on the Fisherman's Fund, which is intended to be the payer of last resort. In closing, I want to thank you for giving us this opportunity to testify, and thank you very much.
Are there any questions for Ms. Leach? Thank you.
Thank you
for your testimony. And having no other invited testimony, I will open up public testimony. I see no one online. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing no one, I will close public testimony. Are there any further questions or comments for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we will be setting this bill aside for a further hearing on Thursday. And on Thursday, with the will of the committee, I would like to move this bill from committee at that time. If you have any amendments to the legislation, please discuss them with the sponsor and have them to my office by 3:00 tomorrow afternoon. The next hearing of House Fisheries will be this Thursday, April 4th at 10 a.m. And at that time, the committee will hold, as I just stated, its second hearing on House Bill 105, as well as the first hearing on House Bill 65, the governor's raw fish tax repeal. If there's anything else, as seeing nothing else to come before this committee, I will adjourn at 11:08.